Okay.
Maybe it's sponsored research, I mean, because there are life problems.
Exactly. So my plan, as I said, was to give a first overview in the first talk, and now I'm going to talk a little bit about this reformulation, which transfers this whole problem from one of surfaces in R3 to one of surfaces in a four manifold in TS2, which is a complete geometric reformulation, which allows you, in fact, to forget about R3 and allows you to use the extra space that you have in the four dimensions to approach the problem completely differently. The next talk will be on the analytic side, which is both the global analysis side and the kind of the mean curvature flow side. And then the final talk will be about just, well, things since then and implications and ways in which perhaps the techniques that we've developed in the proof could be of use in other areas. So let me talk about this geometric reformulation. And somehow it's like a lost canonical example or something that's kind of at the back of a lot of, I guess you could think of classical surface theory, you can reinterpret it entirely in terms of what I'm going to talk about. And at the heart of it is a double fibration. So you can think as you go through this of how this can be generalized, and there are many different ways where it will be generalized, and certain elements will transfer and certain won't. So I'm going to just do explicitly the simplest one. So let's just write maybe as T1 of R3 to be the unit sphere bundle of R3 with the Euclidean metric of R3. So, of course, that's just R3 across the 2 sphere. And what I'm interested in is the following double projection. So we start off with the sphere bundle, which is a 5 manifold, and we project off down onto the R3, the standard projection, which throws away the vector and gives you the point where it's attached. And then the other, maybe I'll call that pi1, and this one I'll call pi2, which is a different projection, and it'll give us TS2. So let me say what this second projection. So pi2 is a map that's going to take a point in R3 and a vector, I think I called it V, and gives us an equivalence class. And I'll write down the equivalence relation now in a second. The equivalence relation is that P1, V1 corresponds to, I guess I could put vector signs here if I think of S2 is sitting in R3, unit vectors. So P2, V2, if there exists a map from 0, 1 into R3, which is a line segment, such that gamma at 0 is P1, and gamma at 1 is P2, and the dot, the tangent vector, also corresponds. So in our picture, in R3, you would have a point and a vector, some other point and some vector, and if they give you this, they lie in the same straight line, well, then you consider them to be equivalent. So this is an equivalence class. It has a one-dimensional kernel. So when you quotient out by this, this is the geodesic action. I mean, there's many different ways in which I can motivate this. But what you end up getting is this quotient. So this, if you take T1 of R3 and you quotient out by this thing, what you get is the set of oriented lines in R3, and as I mentioned last day, this is quite easily seen to be the tangent bundle to the 2 sphere. So this is the double fibration that essentially that we use to transfer geometric information from the left-hand side to the right-hand side and back, as it were.
The unit length.
So S2. So you could think of them as vectors or as points on the sphere either. Okay, we first think of them as unit vectors. Okay, the other thing is, I guess we also have a natural projection onto S2, just a further projection, which I'll call pi. And to close this all up, actually, usually I look at that S2 as sitting inside R3, as the unit sphere in R3. And I'll do that in coordinates in a second. But just to see that this gives us correspondences. So a correspondence is a map that takes a subset of a space, points to subsets, or vice versa. So it's a little bit it's more general than just a map. And we use pi 1 and pi 2 for that. So, for example, if you take a point P in R3 and you look at the inverse image, the set pi 1 inverse, and then you apply pi 2 to it, what you're going to get is a subset of TS2. And this subset is the set of lines that pass through P. So this is the sphere of lines through P, which and these this you think of it as an S2 sitting in TS2. It's a section, actually. It's a section of TS2. So this was the correspondence space that I wrote down yesterday. Last day I said, a point in R3 goes to a sphere. Well, it's exactly by this. Pi 1 inverse pi 2 gives you a sphere. And then going back the other way, well, it's kind of the definition. If you take a line, I'll usually use the notation gamma for a line, an oriented line, in TS2. And if you then take pi 2 inverse, and then you project using pi 1, what you get is, well, you just get an oriented line. An oriented line in R3. So this is our correspondence space at the level of points. A point corresponds to a sphere over here, and a point here corresponds to an oriented line over here. So that's our basic correspondence space that we're going to use. Now, what's surprising is that this whole picture can be geometrized. And although vestiges of it have been seen in different places, what we tried to do and what we did, I guess, over the last few years, is put this all together and then systematically try and exploit this geometric structure. Okay, now, in order to... we've written slightly abstractly, but, of course, really, I'm really a differential geometer, so I like to be able to compute things. So let's just write down very clearly what exactly this map is and how we could use it to compute things. Ultimately, we're going to have a metric, we're going to have a Kähler structure, so we'll want some local coordinates to explore that. So let's try and set up a set of coordinates for this map up above. So let's just take standard Euclidean coordinates, x1, x2, x3 on R3. Now, S2, in fact, on S2, for S2 we'll take complex coordinates, xi, xi bar, which were given by stereographic projection from the south pole just for S2. All right, so that just gives coordinates on S2. Now, we can lift those to coordinates on TS2. See, what I want is I want nice coordinates here and coordinates here that we can transfer information back and forward. So I need coordinates on TS2. So I'll just say we kind of lift them to these to coordinates. Let's call them xi and eta. I'll drop the bar. So this is an element of these are elements in C2. Xi and eta on TS2. If you have a vector x in TS2, well, its projection is, say, xi, then, say, x is going to have a basis, some complex eta bar d dx xi bar. So these give you natural coordinates. Eta and eta bar give you natural coordinates from... I mean, you have this on tangent bundles of any manifold. You can always lift the coordinates up in this manner. So we get some natural complex coordinates xi and eta on the tangent bundle to TS2. The next thing is, in fact, what I like to think of, as I said, I drew this picture the other day where I took an oriented line and I moved the direction vector, so it was at the origin, and I moved the perpendicular vector, so it was tangent. So you could see the tangent bundle of the two-sphere sitting inside R3. Well, I'm going to do that. I'm going to think of that S2, this xi, the coordinate that I chose, to be exactly related to Euclidean coordinates as if the S2 is sitting inside R3 as the unit sphere in about the origin. So then let me just give you explicitly then this relationship. So if we let phi be the following map, so phi be, which way did I do it? Pi 1 after pi 2 inverse. Let's think what that is. Well, as I said here, pi 1 after pi 2 inverse of a point pi 1 after pi 2 inverse of a line is a line in R3. So it's a one parameter family of points in R3. Okay, so it's going to take a line, which is given by coordinates xi, eta on TS2, and it's going to pick a point on that line by choosing a parameter R. And suppose it gives you x1, x2, and x3. Then the explicit coordinates, which you can write down, is x1 plus ix2 is given by 2 times eta minus xi squared eta bar over 1 plus xi bar squared plus 2xi or. So that's complex. And then you have your x3, which is minus 2 times xi eta bar minus plus xi bar eta over 1 plus xi bar squared plus 1 minus xi. So, if you fix xi and eta, you're thinking of that as fixing a particular line, and you let r go from minus infinity to plus infinity, this, you can see, parameterizes, it's a unit parameterization of a line in R3. When r is equal to 0, it's in fact the point closest to the origin. So, this point here will be r equal to 0, and then r equal to 1, or equal to minus 1, etc. So it gives you a parameterization, and again, the positive direction is an oriented line. So this contains all of the information of this double vibration. Now, you can play this, I'm interpreting it in this way, but of course, you can play this game any other way. But it's a canonical geometric description of this double vibration. And you can use this now to transfer at least point information back and forward between R3 and TS2. Okay, you can see, for example, xi is obviously the direction of the line. Why is that? Well, because as r changes, it changes by exactly the spherical factor from stereographic projection. So this all fits together. Okay, I guess these two terms here are the ones that are not quite so obvious. This term is kind of obvious. Okay, so this is very explicitly the relationship between R3 and TS2, and you can play this game now any different way, transferring back from TS2 back to R3 or vice versa. The question, though, of course, is, well, what geometric structure? We've no geometry here. I mean, we have the Euclidean metric on R3, but what geometric structure, canonical metric structure, would you have on TS2 that fits with this description as lines in R3? And that's the next question. So to understand that, we have to kind of understand, first of all, what the tangent space to TS2 at a line in TS2. We want to try and view that. So take TS2, the space of oriented lines, choose a line in it, gamma, and what's the tangent space to TS2 at that line, which should be a four-manifold, linear four-dimensional space. So how will we see that? Well, classically, this is seen to be the orthogonal Jacobi fields along the line. So again, we want to see this in R3 along the line gamma, the oriented line gamma. So what do we mean by that? Well, by that we mean you've got a vector, V, maybe we'll call it, which is in the tangent space to R3 along the line gamma. So at each point on the line gamma, you have a vector. And what do you want? Well, you want it to be orthogonal to the line. So let me just call that as V dotted with gamma dot is 0. So it's an orthogonal Jacobi field. And it must satisfy the Jacobi equation. Now, the Jacobi equation, of course, in Euclidean space is rather easy. Second derivative of V with respect to the parameter along the line is 0. But let me write it down in general. In general, it would be or V gamma dot in the gamma dot direction must be 0. Okay, so that's your Jacobi field. Your Jacobi equation. It's a linear equation, and on a six on a vector with a second order equation, it gives you a six dimensional space. But then your orthogonality then cuts it down so that you actually just get a four dimensional linear space. So this is the classical interpretation of an infinitesimal variation of a line. The picture, of course, you have your oriented line gamma, and then your nearby line. Maybe I'll draw it. So this is your nearby line, is given by this vector field V, which is kind of, well, in this case, will be just linearly changing. So that's the classical picture of what the tangent space to the space of oriented lines at a particular line would be, how you'd interpret it in R3. This is, of course, all in R3. Okay, so these are the orthogonal Jacobi fields identified as the tangent vectors. Now, again, in our case, in R3, of course, this is 0. But I'll just leave it as R for a second. I want to make a comment about that in a minute. Okay, so now, the first thing that we get once we have that picture is we get a complex structure. Well, okay, it's an almost complex structure, but anticipating where it's going to go, you can define J, a complex structure. So what you want? You want it to be from the tangent space at that point to itself. Whose squares up to be -1, right, as an almost complex structure. How are we going to define it? Well, J of your vector V, which is at some point gamma, is, well, I don't know, you rotate about gamma through 90 degrees. So you take your Jacobi field, and you just rotate it through 90 degrees, you get a new Jacobi field, squares up to minus the identity, and so therefore it gives you an almost complex structure, very straightforwardly. So I should say almost complex structure at this point. Let me just note, in general, this will only work for spaces of constant curvature. If you wanted to now drop anything to do with R3, the problem is that if you take a Jacobi field and you rotate it, how do you know it stays a Jacobi field? So even the definition of this map as from the tangent space to the tangent space only works. So this only works on the space of oriented lines of a 3-manifold, right? Because obviously this whole thing could be generalized. You could look at nearby geodesics, same, it would satisfy this Jacobi identity. Our Jacobi equation would be your tangent space. So if and only if this metric is constant curvature. So this works in S3, H3, and R3. This complex structure exists, or this almost complex structure, I guess it is at this stage. Okay, so... Yeah?
Did you mean to write JV as rotating gamma or V?
Sorry, I'm saying rotating about gamma. Sorry, it's my own. Yeah, so you have a line, and I'm just talking about rotating about gamma. Rotate V about gamma through 90 degrees. Right. And it's an oriented line, so you have a well defined sense of that.
You already have a complex structure from the complex coordinates.
Exactly. So now the point. Okay, so proposition. Okay, what I said here is almost complex structure, so I should have said this is just an almost complex structure because it squares up to my... It has an integrability condition. So first of all, I should say J is integrable and x, I, and eta are complex coordinates for it. So in other words, J of the complex vector d dxi is I times d dxi. And J of d eta, same thing. Exactly. Okay. So this all fits together. So as I say, there are multiple ways in which we could motivate and define any of these objects. I could have defined them entirely in terms of complex structure, and then questions might have been asked about, well, what happens on the other side? Do you close it up, etc.? But anyway, there's a very simple canonical way. You can see that it's very closely associated with the Euclidean group. It's a rotation. Okay, so that's the complex structure. So you have this complex structure. I guess for my own interest in this, this complex structure was used by Hitchin in his paper 80, in the 80s on monopoles. So this complex structure, I think he even traced it back to Weierstrass representation of minimal surfaces. So this is a classical object in some way. The other part of the picture is the symplectic structure. Now, once again, symplectic structure can be defined quite generally on space of geodesics for any dimension. It's more flexible, of course, than the complex structure. let me just define the symplectic structure. I said there's more than one way to define it. So let me just define it as follows. So think of the round metric. If you think of the round metric as an identification of the tangent space and the cotangent space of S2, and then you take the canonical symplectic structure. So take the canonical symplectic structure on T star S2 and then pull it back using this. So then the symplectic structure we choose is the pullback with the round metric of the canonical. Okay. Just, I think it's just kind of the cleanest way to it. Now, that doesn't generalize quite as well as when you define it. You have, in fact, what you have in this double vibration, in the sphere bundle, you have an invariant contact structure. So therefore, in fact, it descends to the quotient, and then you can define this in much more general sense. But anyway, this is probably the nice way. Now, of course, at the start, there's no clear reason why this has anything to do with that. But once you have two things, you could certainly put them together, and we define the metric just to be the composition of this symplectic structure with this complex structure. And then we see what properties this triad have. Okay. I guess the first thing saying, well, before I write down explicitly the full details of what this structure has, you can define this G to be a kind of an angular momentum. So if you take your Jacobi field, if you've got your Jacobi field V, then GVV, the length of that, is kind of an angular momentum. It measures the amount that your nearby geodesic, your nearby line, is twisting around this thing. So if it's parallel to it, it'll be null. This will be a null vector. On the other hand, if it intersects it, it'll also be null. So immediately you can see that this metric can't be definite if you have that interpretation as an angular momentum. In fact, you can have different ways in which it can be null. It can be null because it's parallel, it's separated by an isometry, a translation, or it intersects, in which case it's related to the original line just by a rotation. So you can see you have different types of nullity that comes into this metric, and you can see that, in fact, very quickly then when you define it that way, that it's not a definite metric. Okay, so let's assemble what the properties of this structure. So this is myself with Wilhelm back in 05. And the first thing is that this symplectic structure is compatible with J. In other words, if you apply J twice to omega, it's the same as omega, it's invariant. So in fact, all the properties that you want, so TS2 with this metric, symplectic structure, and omega is Kähler. So they all fit together. Now, I use the term Kähler to allow the indefinite case. I mean, some people might say Kähler means definite metric, but I'm explicitly saying let's not do that. Let's assume that the signature can be anything. And it turns out that for a Kähler structure, it's either definite or it's split signature 2-2, and we're in the latter case. So G has signature 2-2. What else can we say about it? It's conformally flat. It's scalar flat, because it's Kähler that follows, but in any event, it's scalar flat. The other thing is not Einstein. It's not an Einstein Kähler metric. So it's not a flat metric. Okay. Moreover, the isometry group of this metric, let's just get rid of reflections and look at the connected component of the identity. The isometry group of this metric is isomorphic to the isometry group of the flat metric on R3. In other words, it's exactly rotations, semi-direct product translations, R3. Now, this is the exceptional geometry that occurs in dimension in dimension 3. Oops, sorry, just rubbed down what I wrote. Excuse me. Paying attention, sorry. Just write that last bit again. The isometry of G is isometry of the Euclidean, which is SO3. Let me just maybe mention in our coordinates. We have coordinates now where we can describe this thing a little bit more concretely. So how do rotations act? Well, rather simply, So rotations act by the derivative of rotations on S2, of rotations taking S2 to S2. So you take your SO3 acting on S2 just by fraction linear transformations. For example, you want to lift SU2, and then you look at the derivative of that, of those actions. The derivative of those actions will map TS2 to TS2, and that's your rotation. So it's very natural and canonical the way in which rotations act. Translations, well, how do translations act? Well, translations act by addition in the fiber direction. This is TS2, so of course it has a linear fiber, and translations are precisely addition of a quadratic holomorphic section. So here, the direction, notice when you translate a line, its direction doesn't change. So if you like, your xi goes to xi, xi be the first vector being, the first complex coordinate telling you the direction of the line. And how does eta change? Well, eta changes, so xi eta, let's say, xi eta goes to xi comma eta plus, I'll put in a few factors just to keep it exactly kosher, alpha bar xi squared, where alpha is an element of C and B is an element of OR. And this is a translation. It's a three real parameter family. I've written it in a particular way because I chose stereographic projection from the South Pole. I mean, I'm doing it so this whole thing fits together. And this allows you to, this is translation of the origin, is exactly this addition of this quadratic holomorphic section. You'll notice it's not all quadratic. I've taken a specific three real parameter family of quadratic holomorphic sections. These are the Lagrangian ones. That's
Now, if we're thinking of the S2 not as CP1, but as S2 and R3,
yes,
then rotation could just act by rotations.
Yes.
Of both the tangent vector and the point.
Yes.
And then the translations would act by project onto the orthogonal component of
No, you would
project onto the tangent plane? I mean,
you would add this section to the tangent plane. You add this at each point.
Right, but yes. if you're translating by a certain vector,
yes,
project that vector onto the tangent plane and add that.
I don't see any projection. You have it in the tangent plane simply because you're taking an orthogonal parameterization, if that's the way you're thinking of it, right? Your second vector is automatically orthogonal to the S2, and then you're just adding a vector which is given by this to that. You'll still be attached at the same point because your translation is not going to change the direction of the line, but it's just going to add a linear factor, or this quadratic factor, linearly to the vector part of it. So it's written there in complex coordinates, but you could probably write it down just in terms of u and v, that, you know, if you want the original vector, u is your direction vector, v is your perpendicular distance from the origin. This is like a complex representation of it.
Yeah, but if you think in terms of...
Understand what the vector part is. So that's telling you the point at which your line came closest to the origin?
No. In fact, so essentially, I mean, the picture we have is we have a u vector, which is your direction, and your v is there. Now, in our with certain restrictions on them, u dot v are perpendicular, and this is of length 1. Okay, so that's the kind of vector picture of it. Now, what I've done is I've replaced u, your direction vector, now as this complex coordinate, and this thing here as eta. Now, if you translate that, this xi is not changing. So that's reflected in xi going to xi. However, your eta is going to change. Well, how is it going to change? Well, it depends on a few things. It depends where the origin is going to, first of all, but it also depends where this line is as to what exactly you're adding. And this just gives you exactly the combination depending on where the direction of the line.
But if you think of v not as, you know, the coordinates of the nearest point, but think of it as the coordinates of every point projected onto the plane perpendicular to u.
Okay, well, if you want to do that, that's fine, but I prefer to do it this way because it fits with the complex coordinates, and when I want to compute things in a geometric sense, I want to forget about any extra compatibility condition I want to have, like to project it down to the perpendicular. I do the projection and I forget about any extra stuff that might be there. It also allows me to ensure that my parameterization along the line is unique, and I don't have to worry about that. Whenever I need it, I can pull that out. Okay, so this is the way the translations and rotations act on the space of geodesics, and the question is, well, how do we know what's the metric? How does the metric become, how is it invariant under that? So that's the last thing. I just want to write down explicitly what is the metric, so in these complex coordinates. So ds squared, the metric, is just given by 2, well, again, the factor, isn't it? so important. Squared. So again, you get these spherical factors coming in. Dxi, d eta bar minus dxi bar d eta. And then I have an extra part. Let me see which way it goes. Plus 2 times psi. Okay, plus 2 xi bar eta minus xi eta bar over 1 plus xi xi bar, and that's dxi dxi bar. So that's a square bracket there. That's the metric just written in complex coordinates. And that's the neutral metric. So in some ways, you could just start with that metric and say, OK, well, let's look at this metric, show that it's invariant under these actions, and then show that its isometry group is, in fact, precisely that the connected component of the identity is the same, and you have an invariant metric on the space of oriented lines, which you can then check. Well, you find its signature, you can see that it's conformally flat, that it's scalar flat, but it's not an Einstein metric. It has some kind of source in its Ricci curvature.
Is it easy to understand in terms of the original Jacobi field?
Well, as I said, it's... Okay, so the one way to do it, the way I would have think of it, if you take your oriented line and you take the perpendicular plane to it and you look at a nearby line, right, and you project that down into the orthogonal plane, you now look down, if you look down on it, here's your line coming straight out at you, and this one here would be some parameterized line in that plane. It's the angular momentum of this about that. That's exactly what it is. It's the angular momentum of the Jacobi field about the line. And that's the interpretation of the metric that you can get. It's the area of the parallelogram, right? You can write it down. So if it intersects the line, in which case we'd have zero, that's one way in which the vector can be null. And if it's parallel to the line, it'll be coming straight out, and you won't see it. It'll have, again, zero. And that'll be because it's an infinitesimal translation away or an infinitesimal rotation away. And they're what gives you the nullity in the metric. It's this isometry group. Okay, now, you could ask questions, interesting questions, like, okay, well, what do the geodesics of this metric look like? What do they look like? Well, a geodesic will be any curve in TS2 will be a ruled surface in R3. So you can see it turns out that, well, the geodesics of this metric correspond to either planes, where you take a line and you just translate it, or you twist it as you go. It's a helicoid. So either the helicoids or planes correspond to the geodesics of this metric. Right? So there's a natural way in which, so you can totally classify them, you can relate the geodesics in this curve to ruled surfaces in R3. And, you know, you can start reinterpreting much classical geometry in terms of this metric. Because the Euclidean group is there, it allows you to look at any Euclidean problem in R3 you can interpret in terms of this metric. Whether you can solve it or whether it makes it easier or worse is a different matter, but certainly you can do that. Now, what we're interested in the proof of the conjecture is to look at surfaces. So let me just try and mention, so it's just linear algebra, but it highlights the difference between the definite and the indefinite case, so neutral Kähler geometry. So just at a point. So just you can take R22. Forget about the specifics of this metric. What's different about these neutral metrics? So let's look at the linear algebra at a point. So let me just make sure I get that. Okay, so let's take R4, and let's take canonical complex structure, and symplectic structure, and metric. And assume this is Kähler. So they all fit together, okay, just at a point. It's really just the linear algebra of it, so we don't even need that symplectic structure is closed. And I assume here that here your metric G is the diagonal 1, 1, epsilon, epsilon, where epsilon can be plus or minus 1. Okay, so let me take the two cases so I can try and contrast the definite Kähler with this neutral Kähler. And what I'm interested in is take a plane P in R4, or R22, whichever it is, a plane, and assume it's spanned by two vectors, spanned by V1, V2. So take two vectors, V1, V2. And the proposition is as follows. Is that if you take your symplectic structure and you evaluate it on V1, V2, your symplectic form, and then you square it, and you add epsilon times the determinant of the following 4x4 matrix, V1, V2, JV1, JV2. That determinant of that 4x4 matrix, what you get is the determinant of the metric over I and J, where it's VI, VJ. And epsilon here, plus or minus 1, depending on the signature of the metric. So this is just, I guess, just linear algebra, really. It's just at a point. Doesn't have any more content than that. But it highlights the difference between the definite case and the indefinite case. So, before I say that, let me just note here, this equals 0 implies your plane is holomorphic, or sorry, Lagrangian, excuse me, it's 0. If your plane is Lagrangian, this is going to be 0. On the other hand, if this is 0, it's precisely when it's a complex plane, when it's a holomorphic plane. So this is always greater than or equal to 0, but in fact, it's equal to 0 implies if and only if P is holomorphic. Okay, so in fact, when epsilon is positive, normally people throw this away and you get what's called a Wirtinger inequality. So it's the standard. So in the, so as a, the first corollary, for epsilon, for the definite case, this essentially says that the symplectic area is bounded by the metric area. So it's known as the Wirtinger inequality. So let me call it the area with respect to omega smaller than or equal to the area with respect to your metric. You just, because that's a definite term, that determinant is always positive, and your epsilon is plus 1, so you can throw it away, and then you take the square root and you'll get, right, so this is the Wirtinger inequality. It's referred to in the definite case, which is used in various manners. Okay, in the definite case, it's a much richer situation. So this is where we take leave of a lot of the stuff that holds in the definite case. In the indefinite case, we see the signature of the metric can change. In fact, the metric can be degenerate. Right? So if you have an indefinite metric, you can have perfectly well-defined surfaces where the metric is degenerate. So this determinant could be zero. So this is a minus, so it's this minus this. And what you see is that the metric measures the failure to be Lagrangian against the failure to be holomorphic. And it's this flexibility that we use over and over again. Right? It's the difference between symplectic and holomorphic is expressed by that. So in particular, let's see what it tells us. So again, I'll just write it down maybe. This just says omega V1 V2 squared minus this determinant equals the determinant over I and J of the metric. So here your J comes in here, and this is your G, VI, VJ. So clearly, if you're Lagrangian, the determinant is negative. So Lagrangian are associated with Lorentz. So P is Lagrangian implies P is Lorentz. In fact, not just Lorentz, it could also be degenerate. Because this, if it's both Lagrangian and holomorphic, well then the determinant of the metric is zero, of the induced metric is zero, so it's a degenerate case. So you have P is Lorentz or degenerate. On the other hand, if P is holomorphic, that means this thing is zero, this J thing, this determinant is zero, and so you end up with the determinant is positive, right? Which means that, well, it's definite. So P is maybe indefinite or indefinite. I mean, sorry, definite, positive or definite, negative, depending on how you choose. So it's definite or, again, degenerate. And in fact, it goes a little bit further. As we see later, being Lagrangian, you get it degenerate precisely when it's complex. So what you end up with is Lagrangian surfaces are associated with hyperbolic problems with degeneracy at complex points. And now you begin to see why the Carathéodory conjecture is a difficult problem. While it's stated in R3, it's really about degeneracy of Lorentz metrics. And that area in geometry is not one that there's any simple closed answers to. Many questions that you could pose. Okay, so this dichotomy here is the one that we exploit over and over again, going, if you can move something from being Lagrangian to holomorphic, you'll elliptize the problem. Instead of a hyperbolic problem, you'll tend to have an elliptic problem with respect to the metric with degeneracies at Lagrangian points. So you kind of have this parity, right? Lagrangian is Lorentz except at complex points where it's degenerate. Holomorphic is definite except at Lagrangian points where, again, it's degenerate. So these two interact in a way that just does not happen at all in the definite case. It has a much richer structure. Okay, so again, that's just linear algebra. What we're really interested in now is come back to classical surface theory revisited, because that's, of course, where the conjecture lies initially. Classical surface theory revisited. Okay, so what is it that we're interested in? Well, it was this basic relation that we had. So let S, I'll try and use the same letters the whole time, be a smooth surface. And then the idea is let sigma, which is a subset of TS2, be the set of oriented, I assume it's oriented and it's at least smooth enough, at least C1, I'll assume smooth, oriented, the whole thing. So let sigma be the oriented normal nines. Oriented normal normals to S. Okay. So maybe I'll state as a few propositions. What properties will sigma have? Well, the first thing is it's Lagrangian. I mentioned this the last day. Proposition, if you have a two-parameter family of oriented lines, in other words, a surface in TS2, well, then locally it's orthogonal to a surface in R3. The lines are orthogonal to if and only if this symplectic structure, which I defined earlier, is zero on the surface. So first of all, sigma is Lagrangian. Right? So your symplectic structure, this is part of the kind of canonical features of this metric. Okay, so it's Lagrangian, but now we come back here and say, well, if it's Lagrangian, well, then the induced metric on sigma must be either Lorentz or degenerate. And it's going to be degenerate precisely at the complex points where this thing is zero. So let me just get the right order to say this. So G, the metric G restricted to sigma, is Lorentz or degenerate. Okay. In the former case, it's Lorentz. Now, if it's Lorentz, it'll have a pair, the null cone will just be null curves. What are the null curves? They're precisely the lines of curvature on your surface in R3. Right? So the geometry really captures everything. The null curves on your surface correspond to the principal foliation on S. The lines of curvature, principal foliation on your surface S. And of course, this principal foliation has a degeneracy precisely at umbilic points. And that's exactly where this is degenerate, where it's a complex point. So this all starts tying in together. And degenerate points here on your surface in TS2 correspond to umbilic points on S. And so what you've essentially done is metrized this whole classical paradigm in terms of these surfaces in R3, in TS2. Okay, as to whether it gives you a somewhat bigger perspective to look at things. And certainly we've applied it to a number of different old problems that this particular approach gives you just a different enough perspective for you to make some advance on them. Now, what I'm not going to... By the way, this continues... you can continue up in through the jets and say, well, what about the curvature of this surface in TS2? Why is that related to the... Okay, so in fact, let me just say that, although it's not something I'm going to use. So your surface in TS2 is flat, by which I mean the Gauss curvature. It's only a surface. The induced Gauss curvature is zero if and only if your surface S is Weingarten. So Weingarten here means that there's some functional relationship between the lambda one, the curvatures, right, the two curvatures, the principal curvatures. So, for example, minimal surface is a Weingarten surface, CMC surface is a... So any functional relationship between the two gives rise to a scalar flat or flat, Gauss flat, line Lagrangian Lorentz congruence in TS2, or surface in TS2. And, of course, one could go for... We have a flat connection here. In fact, you end up with two flat connections, which give you... Right, so you start looking close to integrable systems. This would take you off in a direction where you try and do classical surface theory as it relates to integrable surfaces. You do it now in terms of these special types of surfaces in TS2. Okay, so that's one avenue that you could certainly explore further.
Now, is this development really using the complex structure, or is it just using the almost complex structure?
Well, at this point, all we've said is the is really the metric, I guess, except here. Here we have this complex structure. As to whether it's almost complex, generalization, I don't know. I'm not sure. The problem is when you try to leave the complex structure and look for almost complex structures that have a nice property that are a bit more flexible, it turns out to be not quite so useful. I think it's not so easy to find such a thing. So I think there's a package that is hard to separate at this point. So I'm not sure if I can answer that. Okay, so far then we begin to see that all of the geometry of the surface comes into the one jet. Now, the way that I always think about TS2, it's like the one jet. We have a geometrization of the one jet, and somehow now we're one derivative higher. And because we're one derivative higher, the curvatures, you know, the lambda 1 and lambda 2 of the surface in R3 give rise to kind of coefficients of the metric in TS2. So you kind of go up a derivative. And in that way, then you have a geometrization of the one jet, and you can try and look at things at the next level up, which is curvature, and you find many identities come out of it. Now, let's look a little bit more at what it is that we are really aiming for. So what about convex surfaces in TS2? Because that's where our main focus is on. Well, first of all, remember to be convex means that your normals continually turn. If the normal didn't change direction as you moved it, you'd have a flat point, right? Infinitesimally, you have a flat point. So if you have a convex surface, so these are parameterized by the direction of the normal. The direction of the normal. The normals, and remember the direction of the normals for us in our complex coordinate is xi. So that means it's a section of TS2. Sigma is a section of TS2. And by which I mean that you can write it as xi goes to xi, comma eta, and eta is some complex function of xi and xi bar. So f here is a map from C to C. So you reduce everything now. When you have a convex surface, you reduce it just to a single complex function from C to C. And all of the local differential geometry for surfaces is encoded in this single complex function. That's locally, of course. Of course, we could do this across all of S2 for closed convex surfaces. Okay, so let's see how this fits in with what we've said earlier. The first thing we've said was we've already said that sigma is Lagrangian. So what does that mean for this complex function f? Well, of course, as Dan mentions, that there's a potential function involved. So it's Lagrangian. So there exists a function or from S, so your surface, your convex surface, into a real valued function or such that this complex function down here is 1/2 of 1, again, you get a spherical factor coming in, del bar of or. And here, differentiation in all this, del is just d dxi. It's the complex derivative with respect to this direction coordinate. These were called Bonnet coordinates back a couple of hundred years ago. I mean, I'm just taking them as one piece of a bigger set of coordinates, but they're fairly standard. Okay, so f. Sorry, I didn't need a vector on that. That's a complex. Bonnet coordinates. Bonnet, as in Gauss Bonnet.
Oh, I was trying to figure out if
yes.
I heard the name before.
Yeah. So it's just parameterization by the inverse of the Gauss map. I mean, that's it. It's nothing more than that.
function in S2?
Well, okay, so because I've got a closed convex surface, of course it's S2, yes. But in general, it's on the surface. Okay, so what's very interesting about this function is, in fact, this R is, in fact, a well-known function in convex geometry. It's called a support function. So the picture is as follows. If you take your surface, your closed convex, well, piece of your convex surface doesn't have to be closed, and you take its oriented normal line, so there's your oriented normal to the point, and there's your perpendicular distance from the origin. Well, the distance from here to here is this real function R. So in a kind of schematic way, your direction is given by xi, this perpendicular vector is given by eta, right? We've thrown away all the u's and v's vectors, and this is, you know, and the distance from here to here. You notice as R goes to R plus c, you're going along parallel to it, along the parallel surfaces. Obviously, it still satisfies this differential equation, so it still has this property. Okay, so if you wanted to look, where would you find any of this? Well, really, I guess pieces of this were probably known in different ways. In the paper, the proof on the archive, this is section 2.1 and section 2.4, but 4.1. But we were just referring to earlier works where we wrote this out and we applied this in different settings. The other thing that's quite interesting that relates us to convex geometry is your TS2 has a linear structure. You can add surfaces, right? Convex surfaces can be added, right? Because you could just add these complex functions. They're just sections. You can add sections. What does that mean? Well, that's Brunn-Minkowski addition in convex geometry. So this is addition in TS2 for sections of TS2 is just a standard thing reinterpreted. It's what's called Brunn-Minkowski addition of convex surfaces. Normally that's applied to closed convex surfaces, and it's used to extract inequalities in convex geometry in all dimensions, in fact, Brunn-Minkowski addition in convex geometry. And in fact, there's another 80-year-old problem, the Blaschke-Lebesgue problem about surfaces of constant width, which we use as Brunn-Minkowski addition, which we reinterpret and manage to make some progress on. I'll maybe mention that at the end. But all of this, you know, little pieces of this you see in many other fields that have, you know, but the overall view of it, I guess, is what we've been trying to exploit systematically. In fact, you give me any real function, you can write down a surface that has that. You might have to go out far enough to get it smooth, right? But if you choose any or, you get a convex surface eventually, out of, you know, close out to infinity. So, in fact, you could throw this function away, f. You could throw that complex function away and work solely with the support function. And in fact, if you look at Hamburger's proof, this is where Hamburger's proof of the index bound. He just uses OR in Banach coordinates and then does power series approximations to this support function. Forgets about all the geometry that we're working with and just gets down to this support function in his and uses power series in the real analytic case. Okay, so let me just finish off this picture for these convex surfaces. What about del bar of your complex function at a point, at a line, is zero if and only if the corresponding point P on S is umbilic. So it really is being holomorphic, right? It's del bar of a complex function being zero at that point. It's precisely that. Now, of course, you can concatenate what I just said here and substitute this in here, and what you get is a complex wave equation for a real function. And it's the problem of finding solutions to that wave equation was well known to be, it was known as the Leuvenner conjecture in the 50s, that this was a reinterpretation of the index bound that Hamburger was seeking in his real analytic paper. So there's a well-known relationship between solutions or problems to do with wave equations and finding umbilic points, isolated umbilic points with given indices on a surface. Right? So, and again, we would come back and say this is all vestiges of this Lorentz metric. This is why you have this relationship between problems in R3, which is definite, with hyperbolic problems, right, for convex surfaces. It's precisely because this metric is lurking around in the background. The other thing might say, well, what about these principal curvature lines? Well, they're just given by the argument, plus or minus pi over 2, of this corresponds precisely to the lines of curvature, or the principal curvature lines, minus curvature. So the argument of this complex function tell you how the lines of curvature of the surface are changing. So in fact, the winding number about an isolated point where it's zero is precisely the winding number of the argument of this of the del bar of this function. Okay, so let me then just give you one or two quick examples to see that, you know, you can write these things down all very explicitly. So if you take, for example, what's the function f equal to zero? What's the surface given by f equal to zero? Well, that's a sphere. Right. And say, what about your support function? You've got a choice of constant here. Well, or equal to just some constant. This is a sphere of radius C about the origin, zero, with center the origin. Center, 0, 0, 0. So the zero section in this picture is just the sphere at the origin, and whatever support constant you choose for your support function, that will give you the orthogonal sphere to that point. If you substitute this into that original formula I gave you with pi 1 and pi 2 inverse, you'll get a parameterization of the sphere. Exactly standard parameterization of the sphere. If you choose something slightly more complicated, well, this, of course, comes close to what I was talking about translations. Minus 2b, I think, minus, I'm going to put a plus, doesn't really matter, minus alpha bar xi squared. So if you take a quadratic holomorphic function like that, you can check, you'll find that it's Lagrangian. The support function for this is alpha xi plus alpha xi bar plus alpha bar xi plus b times 1 minus xi xi bar all over 1 plus xi xi bar plus c. So you can find that these satisfy these two equations. If you sit down and write them all out, you'll find these are equal. And it turns out, notice this is holomorphic. This is a holomorphic function of xi. So in fact, this is again a sphere. This is a sphere of radius c about the point alpha b, which is c cross or, which I'm thinking of it as or3. Again, this is because I chose my stereographic projection exactly from the South Pole, so it all fits together in this way. So you could also say, hang on a second, you just added a quadratic holomorphic function. So this is just a translation of this. Right? One is just a translation of this, although the support function has to change, obviously. And this gives you the explicit way in which the support function changes. Okay. So you can continue, but let me just give you something that's pertinent to what we've been talking about. Let me show you some isolated umbilic points of arbitrary index less than 1. So the simplest example is rotationally symmetric. If R is a function only of the modulus of xi, so it's rotationally symmetric, well then you get an isolated umbilic point, assuming if you get an index at the origin, you can choose it so that del bar of it is 0 at the origin, and when you do that, this has index plus 1. This is the rotationally symmetric case, you have index plus 1. Let's say index 1/2, let me just, 2 over 1 plus 6, I'll just write down one example. You can write, these are easy to construct. As I said, a lot of these things you can construct. The reason why the conjecture appears to be true is very easy to construct all of these of lower index than 1, but it's almost impossible. Well, it seems to be impossible to construct them for higher index. As you increase the power, here, what you find is the index just go down to be negative. And the next one, I guess, I'll just take xi cubed plus xi bar cubed. If you take this, this is a minus 1/2 index. How would you do that? Well, what you do is work out what this complex function f is. My del bars are here. Del bar of it gives you f. Then differentiate it a second time and look at it, and you'll see you have a function, a complex function, which is 0 at the origin and winds around exactly minus 1/2 times. So you can the argument of del bar f then gives you the index. And you can continue. All right, so it's easy. The higher the power you choose, the more isolated umbilic point, the easier it is, but all with negative index, all down lower and lower and lower. And somehow it's clear that something kind of changes when you get to here, because it, you know, here you have a whole free function work that's easy to write down. In this case, when you try and do it, you write down these, you get these finite parameter families worth. But in fact, for the rotation symmetric, suddenly you have the huge load, and then higher, they seem to disappear. You can't seem to construct isolated umbilic points with index bigger than 1 for some reason. Okay, so let me just show you also that you can apply this in a number of different ways. I mean, what we're going to do is we're going to try and go beyond classical surface theory, because we've interpreted it all in TS2, and then we started introducing all these surfaces that aren't Lagrangian. So they don't have any relationship with surfaces in R3. However, you can extend simple results, or extend results in classical surface theory. So let me just take, for example, the torus. So let me write down what is the torus. If you take the rotationally symmetric torus, so if you just think of rotating it around here, and suppose A is that distance here, and this would be C, I think. Well, you can take a constant C anyway. So what would that be? Well, let me write it down, because this gives an interesting perspective on how you can extend it even slightly in the classical surface case. So I'm going to give a two-parameter family. It's not convex everywhere, of course. It has flat points on the top and flat points on the bottom, so I can't parameterize it everywhere by Bonnet coordinates, but I can most places I can. But in any event, I'll just write it down in general. So theta and phi go over the torus, and this is your mapping. So that's your excise. So this is the normals to this rotationally symmetric one, plus or minus A into 1 minus B psi bar, which I'm going to take as this, so it's tan squared phi e to the I theta. So that's a two-parameter family of oriented lines. I've got a plus or a minus, so it's not a graph. When you lift it up from below, you get two directions. That's because on the torus, you have a line that's perpendicular here, and you have over here, you'll have another line that is also perpendicular, so there's two. Now, the support function, which is your perpendicular distance from the origin, is going to be exactly the opposite. Right, so that's where you get a plus or minus, right, coming in. It all becomes degenerate at the top of the sphere, and at the bottom of the sphere you get a whole circle worth. Okay, so when B equals 1, this is the round torus, just exactly as I've drawn there. For B not equal to 1, so you take any other B, this is what I'm going to call the torn torus. Okay, so this comes back to the fact that being Lagrangian in TS2 is a local condition that you can find some support function. But that may not patch together globally, especially when your surface has a non-trivial element of pi 1, as in the case of this torus.
How does B relate to the picture
of
A and C?
Okay, so C, I never get... So my support function, you have to write down, you would have to show, right, where is the real function whose derivative is equal to this? Okay, and then, well, you can do it. It comes in with A here. It's a function A. I think it's A times tan phi over something plus C. And that's your constant C for, right, because this is the whole line perpendicular. The lines are perpendicular to any of the torus as you move out parallel. So to pick out one particular one, you've got to pick out a solution of this equation, in other words, support function or this constant of integration. Right, so C would be your constant of integration here, tells you which of the parallel surfaces you're sitting on. Now, of course, these may intersect and everything, it doesn't make any, you just get a parameterization of that space, right, if that surface mapped into it. Okay, but the B here means it's a torn torus. So the one way to think of this torus, of course, is just to take a circle in the plane and take a line here and rotate it around that line. But if you take a curve that does that, where it's orthogonal here and here, and also C2, I would like at least C2, you can also rotate that around. Okay, and this tear here, well, it's B minus 1 or something, is the relationship there. And what's interesting is that the total curvature, Gauss curvature, on your surface in R3 can be interpreted, well, it's the evaluation of the second Chern class of TS2 on the line congruence. So you can, topological stuff in R3 transfers over to, well, the second Chern class, which is a two-form, which you evaluate on sigma. And, of course, what this means is that for this torus, the total curvature is zero. So this is an extension of Gauss-Bonnet to surfaces where you're allowed to tear them along their normals by an equal amount the whole way around. So they have to be...
The first Chern class.
Sorry?
The first Chern class.
Oh, sorry, first rank. Yeah, sorry, second form, yeah. First year in class. So when you write this down, so therefore, you can extend Gauss-Bonnet to extends to surfaces. Obviously, they have to have higher, genus 1 or higher, torn by a fixed amount along their normals. Because, of course, this doesn't change by deformation. And it's just a simple deformation by this constant b is, in fact, enough in that one example there. So you can kind of see you can get a little bit beyond classical surface theory. Of course, motivation is not really just to do something significantly different to classical surface theory, but it gives you a nice indication that your perspective has now changed and things like Gauss-Bonnet come about just because of things in line space. Okay, so let me just finish just to mention, of course, the main application that I'm going to take this will be the Carathéodory, but as I said, we've applied this over the last few years to a number of problems. One is the Blaschke-Lebesgue problem, another from the 20s. If you have a body of constant width, you want to find what's the one with minimum volume. And that's known in dimension 2 and not known in 3 and higher. It was solved in dimension 2 by Blaschke and Lebesgue. And myself with Henri Ancieux used this method where we used variational methods. We didn't use mean curvature flow or anything, but we used variational methods to show that, in fact, the minimizer must have one of its curvatures constant on smooth parts. So I can explain that at some stage if there's any interest. Also, I guess, you know, the natural setting from the physics point of view is kind of old-fashioned, but certainly interesting is a kind of geometric optics. You know, the geometric optics is surfaces, rays reflecting off surfaces, etc. Well, obviously, rays are oriented lines, and this gives you a natural kind of reflection map, is a map on TS2, which we've used in a number of different circumstances to solve certain types of problems. The other thing, I guess, what's generally called integral systems. So I mentioned briefly about Weingarten surfaces, but there's some close relations with integral systems of classical surfaces and this Weingarten condition, which is scalar flat Lorentz surfaces in a neutral metric. Okay, etc. But you can see that at this level, you're reinterpreting things, and it's not immediately obvious whether you're going to get that much more out of it, but certainly the perspective is new enough that you can improve on certain results from a more classical setting. In the next talk, I'll talk more about the analytic side of it, which really uses this setting, translates everything into TS2, and then uses some global analysis and PDE to prove this Carathéodory conjecture. Okay, I'll leave it there.
I mean, this is a very pretty reformulation.
Yes.
I very much like it, but we kept sort of keeping track of, you know, what really requires complex coordinates, and I think the answer is nothing.
Possibly.
That except all the equations, like that f equals, you know, 1/2 d bar r,
yes,
is, you know, you could just as well say you've got a real value function on the sphere, and you know, your f is really a deformation, it's a tangent vector.
Mm-hmm.
Saying the tangent vector is a 90-degree rotation of the gradient of a real value function.
Okay.
So I think that everything that you did here, you know, can be done in a way that is sort of more explicitly rotationally invariant, and that there's a nice way of seeing the symplectic form, you know, and the metric that just intrinsically in R3 without thinking of the two sphere as being CP1.
Yeah. In fact, there are many ways in which this can be done more cleanly in some sense, but you still at some stage, I mean, my motivation in doing this is that ultimately, I have to compute things. I have to have things flow. I have to work out a higher order, the second jet. And in that setting,
sure.
Complex coordinates, I need some set of coordinates. And these complex coordinates are like God-given. They capture everything that you need to know. Now, of course, they may capture it, but they may not be necessary to capture it. I fully agree. In fact, you can really most cleanly describe this whole picture in terms of Lie groups. I mean, that's the way you can do it. You can do it with Lie groups and Lie algebra and look for invariant metric. You know, you can go. And we've done that, I guess, for geodesic spaces on constant curvature, symmetric space of rank 1, you know, and you can see that there's an interesting class of these invariant metrics, and that's certainly the cleanest, but it's very hard to compute anything with them. It's very hard to do submanifold theory, because I guess the new thing that we're trying to do is see how submanifolds on one side of that double vibration relate to submanifolds on the other side, and geometrically relate those two, and in that situation we really need some form of coordinates, but I don't doubt there are maybe better ways for someone who's never going to go any further, it might be easier ways or better ways to describe it. Yeah.
Description of submanifold theory in R3 is a very old one.
I know.
Well, not very old, actually. I guess I used to say 100 years old, but now it's
yes.
But,
yes. Well, the other thing I think that's kind of interesting is what I would think of as R3 is useful for on the four-manifold side is just to look at it to give you the natural paradigms for a neutral metric. I mean, who would have ever thought that a neutral metric, should it be Kähler-Einstein, should it be, you know, conformally flat? What's the geometric natural paradigm for a neutral case? So I would say the R3 setting for submanifold, what it's giving you is at least the natural set of geometric objects you want to look at in R3. So, for example, if you take a convex surface in R3, and instead of looking at the normals, look at the tangent lines, right? So what you get is a hypersurface now in TS2, and this hypersurface is pseudo-convex exactly when your surface in R3 is convex. So you get convexity to pseudo-convexity between a two-manifold and a three-manifold. Now, it'll have self-intersection, and there's lots of questions you could ask about that, but it gives you the natural geometric paradigms to study in the four-manifold. It kind of gives you easy things you can compute and check.
Well, thank you again.
Hmm? Yeah.
I look forward to seeing some of the nitty-gritty on
Thursday. Okay. The analysis.